Quit laughing.
I'm trying. Okay. Okay, go.
All right, 3, 2. I'm going to read from the script this time so I don't mess it up again. Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, also reading from my script and still a lecturer at the University of California with a PhD in Italian studies. And I'm also a certified specialist of wine.
You're also a lady. Yes. I'm a lady.
Well, we're definitely women. I'm not sure about ladies.
Oh, true. Okay, fine. I accept that. So we're kind of celebrating International Women's Day / casting a spotlight on some of the realities of womanhood in Italy. And I know that this is a pretty huge topic. It's also one of the favorite topics of mine to listen to Danielle talk about. So y'all are in for a treat.
Well, I think we both end up talking a lot about this because in addition to us being interested in it, it's a very of the moment topic. I definitely remember wanting to do work on things like this between talking about women and food or women's writing about food or women right now in the food world and people thinking of it as a really both a niche topic and also something that felt a little heavy-handed and not particularly attractive to a wide audience. Say, for example, the 49-ish% of the world population that's not female. But now that's sort of changed, not just in the case of people like us considering women in food, but just large scale. It's like big, big shift. So,
yeah. I mean, there has been a big shift. And I think in the Italian press, women have emerged as topics to highlight as chefs and business owners, whereas for much of the late 19th, 20th century and early 21st century, women might, feature as cookbook writers or, the very thin women standing next to chefs as they prepared food on one of the bizarrely lit television shows on Italian TV. but now we're coming out of the shadows and actually getting proper coverage, though I would say, like, if I read another headline that describes, female chefs as being part of the pink movement, I will actually throw up.
it's definitely something that has driven all of us crazy. And if you don't read a lot of Italian news, you may not be aware of the fact that in Italian coverage of these movements, and actually this goes far beyond food, also into politics, where you hear the term quota rosa frequently thrown around, the idea that a female presence is a pink presence in some way and vice versa, which is doubly absurd, not only because it's annoying and also seems to suggest that it's only meant to fill in the quota exactly as the term suggests, of necessary presence of women that would make it so that it's not uncomfortable or politically incorrect. But at the same time, it also relates to pink as a female color, which is a really recent phenomenon. So it has nothing to do with where women have been with respect to professional cooking or more broadly in terms of their relationship with food in Italy. That's for sure.
For sure. For sure. and, if anything, I would think you would associate Italian females with copper, because for so long it was the responsibility of the woman's family in a marriage to provide her with copper vessels for cooking.
That's actually a very good point. And maybe we should start our movement as the copper ladies.
Sure. I'm on board.
I'm going to think of something more clever. Well, during the course of this episode, I'll come up with something that is at least more alliterative, if not better sounding. But speaking of something like that tradition, we could probably start talking about women and food on this topical and temporally appropriate podcast episode by doing a little bit of an initial deep dive and just laying out some broad strokes about how Italian women have related to food, because we have a big glaring icon of the kind of mama in the Italian kitchen, and especially the grandma in Italian American cooking. But neither one of those is necessarily a realistic interpretation of how women were able to interact with food, or how their relationship with it ended up forming or molding the Italian culture of food, generally speaking. And I always start, as you know, with medieval women starving themselves and enjoying only Eucharist, or perhaps the pus of lepers, as their favorite meals. But we can actually skip over my go-to content and make it a little bit further along by just saying that women were always cooks, but rarely in the professional world, because that was a public space. So,
sure.
So that's, you know, where I think you're starting from also, Katie, with the idea of women being posed next to professional men as sort of part of the decorative elements of the professional world of cooking, to be contrasted.
A thin, thick garnish, if you will.
Right, exactly. A flourish of parsley, or a mandolin slice of radish next to a usually very boisterous and stocky Italian chef who showed his prowess in the kitchen also by virtue of his body type. And then you had a similar thing happening with the Italian female home cook, who was also sort of a usually heavy set, loud, over the top, in control of her kitchen, but with the very clear parameters of that space within the home.
Yeah, I mean, Sora Lella comes to mind, a figure in certainly in, you know, Roman film culture, which by virtue of the fact of Rome being the center of cinema production in the mid-20th century, sort of an Italian symbol of like the nonna who is super thick, super loud, runs the kitchen, is quick with criticism of how other people might cook. But when you do often see her in, you know, on television, RIP Sora Lella, by the way, but in her, you know, during her lifetime when she was on television, she was often confined to this sort of like sterile kitchen space, a professional kitchen space, sort of devoid of a larger context.
Yeah, and I think what all of these things have in common is that they're products of a top-down superimposed image of how women should interact with food. So in the kind of pre-modern, early modern period, we don't have necessarily a very good understanding of how an average woman would have felt about food herself, or even her interactions with it in terms of preparations or day-to-day nourishing of her family, even though she would have been responsible for such things for most of the kind of social strata that we might look at, because these were not the kinds of spaces or the kinds of information that we record for history. On the other hand, we do know what expectations were on a grander social level or on a political level. And so when we get into the late 19th and early 20th century, we have these, you know, kind of middle class women who are responding to cookbooks for the first time and eventually write their own in the form of somebody like Ada Boni, who becomes especially famous at that time. And there are other examples, too. And then we also have the input that comes from the important political movements of that time, Risorgimento, Italian unification, and maybe even more important when it comes to food systems, fascism, of course.
Of course. Yeah, we would be remiss if we didn't spend a number of minutes talking about how fascism influenced the larger Italian culture to the present. So take us back to 19, late 22 to 43, and how are women interacting with food in public and private, and in propaganda?
Yeah, so it's a hard shift to some extent at that point, because under the fascist regime, women who were just beginning to sort of come into a moment in which the average household didn't have any staff or professional cooks available anymore, but did start to have some disposable income. And so that we have this sort of what in Italian you would call a piccola borghesia, or a kind of rising middle class that's more populous and has some more disposable income, but that takes care of itself mostly. And so you have women at that time being really interested in cookbooks. They're literate and can enjoy those cookbooks. They have an interest in providing food. Their role in the house is to be the nourisher still, of course. But then you move into the fascist moment, and there's a much firmer government interaction and intrusion into that space. And women are responsible not just for nourishing the next generation, but especially, and there's a huge emphasis on this, for producing the next generation of good Italians. Good Italians are, of course, men who are trained to be good soldiers for the country. And so women are celebrated for being especially the fullest figure that they can achieve, because it reflects their ability to give birth. And in fact, Mussolini, I think we've talked about this before, probably in our coffee episode, the Mussolini and his government, his regime, I should say, actually award women for the amount of children they have, so that we have all of these great photos of women with their blue ribbons on decorating them, and then their 20 or 22 children spread out among before them in these incredible photos in newspapers from the time.
But you do still encounter like old men called decimo, which means the 10th son, like the 10th kid.
Exactly. Yes. Which is a perfect, a horrifying reality realized in a first name. But you can imagine when going past that and you have like ventunesimo.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. I know. I shudder literally at the thought. So women are encouraged to eat a lot and be good childbearers, and they're also firmly linked to the kitchen because they need to be present in this home space as the casalinga, the housewife and cook, who provides for this huge and growing and constantly growing family. And in fact, a kind of a curious reaction to this that some recent scholars have looked into has been the fact that women began to diet in more active and severe ways also at this time, particularly in the 1930s and the later 30s. We see women choosing to eat very little and to have very slight or frail frames as perhaps even a kind of counterculture or a counter political movement, at least.
Yeah, I imagine that like going towards these extreme diets allowed you to control your body, which the government in effect was attempting to control in a very real way.
Yeah, exactly. And that points us back to the medieval mystics, whom I started with at least for a moment, because the idea is always the same. And this isn't limited just to women, but it has to some extent characterized the female relationship with food, especially in fascist and then post-fascist Italy, because the ability to refuse food became the ultimate refusal of external powers over your personal choices.
It's fascinating. Now, to go back to the idea of fertility, having a robust form was evidence of potential fertility, but it was at times the very nature of a woman's fertility, her ability to menstruate, that rendered her unclean for certain spaces. And there are a number of winemakers in Italy Some still kicking around, some recently passed away, that would not permit women to visit the vineyards or cellars, because it was much less awkward to ask them if they were menstruating and therefore at risk for contaminating the whole zone, than it was to just exclude them altogether from the vines and production spaces.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of connecting to other things that we've talked about here, this is something I don't think we brought up actually when we were talking about our kind of broad conversation of wine in Italy and viticultural practices. But your point is really crucial here, because one of the reasons for which women were very unlikely to be winemakers is also because of this real prejudice against women that came from this superstitious understanding of lunar cycles and female menstruation and the interaction, dangerous interaction those things might have with things like grapes, which are apparently even more delicate in their constitutions than women. So.
Yeah, and it's, you know, obviously the line isn't drawn at grapes. My Abruzzese friend is only allowed to bottle tomato sauce with her granny if she reports that she is in fact not on her period. Otherwise, the grandmother won't let her anywhere near the house because the risk is spoiling the entire August harvest and the tomato sauce and whole peeled tomatoes that result from that for a whole year. Like, who wants to risk that? That's crazy.
It's just not a risk I'm willing to take. I, you know me, Katie. I live on the edge. I walk on the wild side, but not when it comes to my tomatoes. So, you know, it seems, you know, and I think what that best demonstrates is that while when we look at that specifically, we say, oh, that's crazy, or that's as a specific idea, I don't accept that. But
it has a deep historical root.
Exactly, exactly. And because of that, we also have these kinds of long-term fallouts that are no longer connected to the original reasoning, but that resonate nonetheless. So
what is the historical root to this ladies being unclean for 3 to 7 days a month?
It's, well, you know, Katie, that's something that that goes back way, way beyond what we are talking about now. It's something that is rooted, that probably comes to the Italian tradition from the early Judaic traditions that separated men and women at particularly those times of a female's cycle, so that women were not meant to be touched or interacted with at all, from often actually a few days, even a week before menstrual cycle began, and for a few days or a week following. Of course, the result is that women are utterly separated from any public interaction for basically 75% of their lives. So.
I mean, well, objectively, that sounds great some days. I can imagine in the grander scheme, it would have negative impact on a woman's role in society.
I do feel like it would be great for me to be like, I'm going to be gone for the next 7 to 10 days. Do not call.
It's also like very, oh my God, that awesome Hulu series. House, the Handmaid's Tale. I'm like, yes, the Housewives Tale. Yeah, it's cool. I belong to like premium television streaming services.
I feel like, okay, well, we'll call it the Copper Ladies, and it'll be about how you cook at home and work, and you have to wear some kind of insane headgear, and you're not allowed to see anybody a week before or after you make your sauce.
I would say, like, I mean, this is sort of, you know, I'm not trying to, like, impress anyone here, but I'm building a pretty sick copper pot collection. Not for my dowry, just for cooking.
And I envy it. I envy it. I've always envied anybody with a significant copper collection. Mine is meager, I would call it.
Well, I highly recommend a visit to Agnone or any of the number of copper-focused villages in South Italy where you can get that stuff very cheap.
Well, and you know, Katie, apart from the fact that you are luckily not obliged to put together a dowry, and you can enjoy these products regardless. Your point there is well taken, and actually could give us another little branch to explore here when it comes to Italian women and their relationship with food, because some of the most purely Italian or most carefully controlled ingredients that we know about and that have gained a special traction on the international market are related to the dowry process, or the integrating of a female child into another male line through the process of marriage. So copper is one very important part, so that the cooking vessels were available. But then things like wine, or especially balsamic vinegars, were usually part of that process, so that when a female child was born, you would begin producing an aged product at the time of birth, and when she was of marrying age, which is a little bit later in Italy than some other places, even in the pre-modern period, it's more like 18 to 20 years old, that female child would then be offered in marriage with the dowry of pots, a cassone, which is her marriage chest, which usually had things like other housewares of value, and then also perhaps a special batch of a vinegar or wine or other ageable substance that would be related to her family's production.
That's Emilia-Romagna exclusively for the balsamic vinegar and other vinegars, or is this something that sort of spreads all over Italy?
Well, I certainly the balsamic is from the where we know balsamic is still famous from, and where the kind of regional delineation for the product is still today. But it's something that would have been practiced in other places, sometimes with relation to another product, but actually vinegars are a fairly popular one, as you can imagine, because vinegar ends up tasting better over time rather than vice versa.
Absolutely.
And, you know, speaking of those kinds of practices, that brings us to the shift that happens as women begin to not get married when their parents tell them to, or when their families decide, and instead to move out of the home at an earlier age to attend college, which is something that happens coincidental with the women's movement in Italy in the 60s, especially in 1968. We use that usually as a year to mark the kind of height of that unrest with women, students, and young people in general in Italy. And they kind of change their role and their relationship with food, because they're not necessarily moving out of the house, staying somewhat less educated than their male compatriots, and also at that point not necessarily having children at a young age, or and thus not being required to maintain a household in the same way.
Yeah, and remind us what the sort of catalyst in women being able to attend college in higher numbers was. It the elimination of the liceo classico diploma,
yeah,
as a requirement.
Yeah, that's I'm glad that you pointed that out, because it's something that's actually has this huge effect way beyond just what women are doing, and certainly just what women are doing with food. It's also a kind of a class divider that was torn down at that time in Italy. In prior to this moment that we're talking about in the 60s, it was either absolutely necessary or de facto necessary to have come from a good family, and really to be a man usually to attend college, because you would have had to go to one of the top formative high schools, known as you point out, Katie, as Liceo Classico. And without the diploma from the Liceo Classico, you wouldn't have been permitted to attend one of the top universities, or any proper laurea or diploma granting university. So that changes and ends up allowing both women as well as people from lower income brackets of Italy at the time to participate in university and to integrate into civic society and into the economy in a way that didn't exist before. It's no you know, it's no coincidence that Italy was in relatively good shape in the 80s compared to today, when they had fuller employment and a much stronger social state. But anyway, that's for another day to complain about.
It's a whole nother podcast, you know.
But so, Katie, you're, you know, living in Italy today as a woman, or maybe even a lady,
just simply as a woman.
Okay, and you're observing what's happening on a day to day basis. You know, how do you feel things have changed, either in terms of opening up, maybe becoming even more restrictive or less, or the conversation is, you know, becoming more dynamic or less so? What are you observing right now?
I mean, I think generally speaking, women who make food or produce food with their families are given a greater amount of respect as they're part of a family unit that generally includes men as well, and aren't subjected to the same objectifying, inappropriate touching, sexualization, infantilization that women who are not working in family businesses but instead establishing their own businesses have to grapple with daily. And although most of my research and writing focuses on, you know, the former category, I spend plenty of time with female chefs and bakers who, I mean, a bit like myself, are subjected to all sorts of denigrating behavior, commentary, and really like a lack of ownership over your own body. I mean, I would discourage anyone who doesn't want to be inappropriately touched from going to a large wine tasting, or for that matter, to like a wine bar, a restaurant, a trattoria, where, you know, friendly overtures are wildly misinterpreted or exploited. And, you know, this is also like a whole nother podcast. Also, I've talked to my therapist about this recently, and I'm like, dealing with it. But, you know, as especially a young woman arriving in Italy at age 22, although I had a university degree and was much more accomplished than men my age, I, you know, constantly have to deal with like mansplaining about basic Italian culture, mansplaining about what pasta or pizza are, not to mention having, you know, wine bar owners or winemakers or restaurant owners really cross personal boundaries, simply because young women in particular are seen as incompetent, inept, and, you know, not in need of like delivering consent in order for them to be approached. So that's me. And you can read more about it in my forthcoming memoir, Starch and Sadness, the Katie Parla story. And no one should feel bad for me in the grand scheme of things, because, you know, an American expat is subjected perhaps to humiliating behavior, but certainly immigrant women from Africa and South Asia and other countries are routinely humiliated in every category of Italian business and culture, which unfortunately, you know, we both have witnessed a great deal of.
Unfortunately, you're right, and I can think of a series of examples, and you're right that it also merits more time when we're talking about something that maybe gives it its full due attention. But I will say that not to just agree with you, but also maybe to draw out a separate contour here that I think you're pointing to, is the fact that particularly for young women, it's there's a double problem in Italy, because there's significantly less respect for youth in Italy than you might expect in at least an American context. This is a generalization, absolutely, but it nonetheless I think bears out very frequently. And so as a young woman, I mean, what you're describing is, as you're describing it, I'm remembering sitting down to dinner with someone after at least I had a PhD and had lived full-time in Italy for 5 years, and had somebody explain the menu to me. And after I had said that I had written a PhD dissertation on food in Italian literature. So it did not seem to stick in any valuable way.
Oh man, I would have sent that guy to the hospital. Yeah, no joke.
I know. It's hard. It's hard. But I do, I think why that's important, besides infuriating us on these particular occasions and perhaps on many more, it also is a problem in terms of the reality of being able to own and operate a hospitality food and beverage business today. Because as we both know well, and you know even better because you're on the ground researching things like this all the time, to be a restaurant owner or a chef or a wine bar owner, operator, or a maker, you're looking at very long hours, late nights, a lot of usually manual labor in addition to the intellectual processes required of you. And that is a young person's game. And as a result of the prejudice that's held against especially young women in Italy, it becomes really difficult to break through those confines. And that can often mean basically eliminating any opportunity to have businesses like that take off, because you age out of the likelihood of being a contender before you are able to command the respect necessary to compete there.
Sure. And this is, you know, we say this all the time, this is not unique to Italy, but hopefully on International Women's Day, we can reflect on the reality of things and maybe seek some improvements.
Yeah, well, and to not end on such a down note, maybe.
Why not?
we keep trying desperately to be optimistic, and then it turns out both of us neither one of us is in our odd couple matching. It turns out we both have exactly the same perspective, so it's totally useless. but I know that you have frequently pointed out to me and to your other adoring fans places that they can patronize, or people they can patronize, who are, if not themselves young women owning and operating businesses, who are supporting an inclusive workplace in the food and beverage world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you want a sort of lady-oriented checklist for Italy, I would include Angela Ceriello of Ecorti, Sara Ciccolini of Santo Palato. Ecorti, by the way, is near Somma Vesuviana, Santa Anastasia, northern slopes, so near Mount Vesuvius. Santo Palato instead is in Rome. The now, like, what, 90-year-old Da Pietro in Melito Irpino in Irpinia Campania is run by a mother-daughter team alongside hubby. And I mean, the list goes on. Angela Margapotti is this fantastic Amaro producer in Puglia. And, you know, with a little bit of research, you can sort of get away from the big name Michelin star male chefs and find people like Rosanna Marziale, who are real live women making fancy food in Italy. Although I would say, check out Santo Palato and Ecorti and Di Pietro first. You get a sense of what the cuisine is like in its traditional forms.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly, I mean, the point is that you can have it all in this way. You can enjoy something that is authentic, traditional, exciting at the same time, really satisfying, and then also support somebody or something, a business or a product that is part of a marginalized community, or at least maybe somebody who didn't have all the same privileges, and kind of lift up the quantity and diversity of participants who are representing Italian cuisine, which I think makes it richer and more delicious for all of us in the end.
Yeah. And just an aside to my fellow journalists, even if a business is advertising itself as being founded and run by a man, ask more questions. Who's really cooking? Who's really in the kitchen? Who's really behind things? Because if I read another article about Mordievai that excludes Sergio Esposito's wonderful life, Mara, I'm going to scream. And, you know, on, you know, we're always ending on like me giving a threatening note to someone. I mean, it's kind of out of control. But, but, you know, it wouldn't be a Gola episode without one of those tirades.
I do. I like the end of our episodes with like a Minacha of the week. Like,
do better. Do research. Talk to people. Learn Italian. Do an interview. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And actually, that's a perfect example because even as you're looking at something that on the surface is carrying the name usually of the father's line, which would have been the tradition regardless, oftentimes today we're seeing actually a whole family, including daughters and sons, wives and husbands, sisters, brothers, cousins, aunts, uncles, everybody working together the way that businesses like that, of course, and naturally are pushed towards. So the only question at that point is giving credit where credit is due and recognition where it requires only one more question, as you said, to find out who's actually back there doing the heavy lifting.
Yeah. And oh, one shout out for Pasta Grannies, which is a really cool Instagram account and YouTube channel that's showcasing, as the name implies, grandmothers, although probably not every single old woman in Italy is a grandmother, let's be real, making pasta dishes and pasta shapes that are unusual and really highlighting the casalinga side of things, which, you know, we talked a little bit about that, not painting the full perspective of womanhood and like agency and so forth, but it's an important project. And actually there's going to be a Pasta Grannies demo class thing going on at the Lotteria in Rome coming up. So if you're Rome bound, check out the Lotteria studio for that cool ass event.
Excellent. Oh, see, we managed to end on an extremely positive note, despite a barrage of threats coming and the heels of it. Yes. Well, speaking of upcoming events, since I think we do have to wrap up because you are on the road, on tour, moving and shaking. All these events that you're mentioning in Rome are preceded by a series of Food of the Italian South events coming up in the next days. Is that right?
That's right. March 12th, Food of the Italian South hits bookshelves, online retailers, indies, you name it, available wherever books are sold. P.S. If you pre-order, hold on to that receipt. Go to my website and you'll find a link to my publisher who will send you a cool PDF, beautifully designed guide with all sorts of photos and tips on how to travel the South. Buy two books and you get a map too, for U.S. residents only. And the 12th, I start this amazing tour to a variety of American locales, Rochester, Milwaukee, Detroit, Chicago, Denver, Philly, Boston, DC, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, whoop, your hood, and the list goes on. But you can find out all about it on my website, katieparla.com/events, or on the Food of the Italian South page on my site, which is the first one you can access in the header. You can also follow me at Katie Parla, while Danielle is available at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet.
And with that, I think we'll see you guys next time on the next episode of Gola. In the meantime, please subscribe, write a review, tell everybody how much you love us, tell your friends to listen, and support us either with your words or your wallet.
Thanks. Ciao.